You're listening to DTFHN for May 13th, 2026. I'm your factory refurbished host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where replying that would add complexity is considered flirting. Today's got that builder energy, the kind where someone says no and 1,000 people say, watch me. Let's get into it. Binary translation is one of those problems that sounds simple until you actually try to solve it. You've got a program compiled for one CPU architecture, say XPLO, and you want to run it on another, say ARM. The naive approach is emulation. Interpret each instruction one at a time. It works. It's slow. The clever approach is JIT compilation. Translate chunks of code on the fly, cache the results, run them natively. That's what QEMU does. It's faster, but it's still doing work at runtime. It's non-deterministic, and you're carrying an entire compiler in your runtime. Elevator takes a fundamentally different path. It does the entire translation ahead of time. Static, deterministic, the whole binary translated before it ever executes. The core technical challenge here is brutal. When you look at a compiled binary, you don't always know what's code and what's data. Compilers interleave them. Jump tables look like data until they're not. Self-modifying code exists. Decades of binary analysis research has produced heuristics, educated guesses about what each byte means. Elevator throws all of that out. Instead, it considers every possible interpretation of every byte. If a byte could be the start of an instruction, it translates it as an instruction. If it could be data, it handles that case too. It produces separate translations for each feasible interpretation and prunes only the ones that lead to guaranteed crashes. What remains is a complete deterministic map of every valid execution path through the original binary. The trade-off is size. The translated binaries are roughly 50 times larger in their text sections. The HN comments are split on whether that's acceptable. One camp says the cache pressure alone will eat any performance gains. The other camp points out that elevator matches or beats QEMU's JIT performance. Meaning even with 50 times more code, the absence of runtime translation overhead wins out. And the determinism matters. When you JIT compile, each run can translate code in a different order, hit different optimization paths. Elevator produces the same output every time from the same input. That's not just an academic nicety. It's a property you want for reproducible builds, for security auditing, for formal verification. You can inspect the translated binary before it ever runs. The first question from the community: where is the source code, which tells you exactly what builders want here? The technique is elegant, the paper is promising, but the real validation happens when people can touch it, extend it, break it, improve it. A binary translator this deterministic, released as open source, would become infrastructure. Released as a paper alone, it stays a citation. So what happens when a company tries to lock down hardware that people already own? A thingy printer company just disabled internet connectivity on machines people already bought and paid for. Bamboo Lab pushed a firmware update that locks their printers to local network only. Unless you authenticate through their cloud, the printers you own, the ones sitting on your desk, suddenly need permission from a server in Shenzhen to work the way they did yesterday. The question nobody at Bamboo wants to answer. What exactly do you think you sold these people? Because a community of developers answered it for them. The Fulu Foundation forked Orca Slicer, the open source slicer software, and restored full Bamboo network support. Internet printing, cloud functionality, everything Bamboo took away. Just put back. The fork works on Linux natively, Windows through WSL2, and macOS is in progress. Pull this thread a little further. Bamboo's original plan was even worse. They announced cloud authentication would be required for local LAN printing too. Your printer, on your network, in your house, needing to phone home to a corporate server before it would extrude a single layer of PLA. They only backed off that part after the community erupted, which tells you everything about where the incentive structure points when no one's watching. One commenter drew the perfect contrast. You beat it, same problem, completely different architecture. Ubiquiti wanted remote access to devices behind EAT, so they built a public relay that handles authentication and connection brokering. The device stays yours. The cloud is a convenience layer, not a kill switch. This is engineering that respects ownership versus engineering that revokes it. The Fulu Foundation isn't just restoring slicer functionality either. They're shipping custom firmware called BMCU. That's the deeper play. Moving the control surface from Bamboo's cloud to the owner's hands, slicer software gets you printing again, custom firmware gets you independence. And this is how open source wins. Bamboo spent engineering resources building a lock. The community spent engineering resources picking it. Bamboo has a product roadmap, quarterly targets, investor expectations pushing them toward control. The open source community has one motivation. Make the thing work the way it should. 1,000 people who just want to print will always outbuild a team whose job is to stop them. The printers are fine hardware, genuinely great machines. The tragedy is a company that looked at an installed base of happy customers and saw a monetization opportunity instead of a community. The fork exists now. The firmware exists. The tools are available. What Bamboo does next matters a lot less than it did last week. We talked about communities building what they need. Well, Google just mass released books that could supercharge that. The URL is googlebook.google, not androidbestnoid.google, not chromebook.next.grl. Google Book. Google named an entire product category after itself, which tells you everything about who this is actually for. In 2013, Google launched the Chromebook Pixel. Beautiful hardware, genuine engineering ambition. By 2017, the Pixelbook arrived and it was legitimately one of the best laptops you could buy. Then Google killed it. Killed the team, killed the roadmap. The Pixel tablet followed, then got deprioritized. Chrome OS and Android were going to merge. Then they weren't. Then they were again. This is the cycle, and it has repeated with enough regularity that you can almost set a calendar by it. Now we have Google Book, Android 17 desktop mode, Gemini integration, a new form factor category announced with the confidence of a company that has never abandoned a form factor category. The feature set reads well on paper. Android apps on a laptop screen, continuity with your phone, AI assistance woven through the interface. The engineering is probably solid. Google employs extraordinary engineers. That was never the question. The question is, what happens in 28 months when the executive sponsor rotates to a different division and the OKRs shift? What happens when Google Book doesn't hit whatever internal adoption metric justifies the team's headcount? We know what happens. We've watched it happen to Inbox, to Google Reader, to Stadia, to the Pixelbook itself. Someone in the comments said they bought a Pixelbook during the middle of its product lifetime, and it was one of the best laptops they ever had. That person got burned. One commenter asked for what this conversation actually needs. A Google Linux. A real desktop operating system built on a standard Linux foundation with a unified design philosophy. Open, forkable. Something that survives a reorg because the community owns it, not because a VP's quarterly review depends on it. That product would outlast every executive at Google. It would outlast Google. That's the point. The Google Book will probably be a fine machine. The hardware will be good. The Gemini integration will be impressive for a product cycle. Maybe two. But the graveyard of killed Google products isn't a meme. It's a pattern with structural causes. Closed platforms live and die by corporate will. Open platforms live and die by usefulness. One of those is a more durable foundation for something you're going to spend $1,000 on. The saddest part is Google has the talent and the resources to build the open thing. They just keep choosing not to. But someone else did choose to build the open thing. Paz Distilling Gemini's tool, calling smarts into a model you can actually own. One commenter pointed out something that reframes this entire project. They noticed that in early Claude code usage, Sonnet would rapidly call tools to gather context, while Opus would sit and reason before acting. Two different strategies for the same problem. And the fast, shallow one often won. Needle is that observation taken to its logical extreme. What if you built an entire model whose only job was to look at a query, look at available tools, and pick the right one? 26 million parameters. That's it. There's a term in architecture called program. The list of functions a building needs to serve. A hospital has an enormous program. A toll booth has a tiny one. You would never design a toll booth with the structural complexity of a hospital. But that's essentially what we've been doing with tool calling. We've been routing what's the weather in San Francisco through models that can also write sonnets, debate philosophy, and generate code. Needle is a toll booth, and it processes traffic faster than the hospital ever could. The technical move here is genuinely interesting. They dropped the feed-forward layers entirely. In transformer architecture, the FFN blocks are where models store factual knowledge. They're the bookshelves. Cactus looked at tool calling and realized you don't need bookshelves if the whole point is to route queries to external knowledge sources. The tools are the bookshelves. So they ripped out the FFN layers, kept only attention, and ended up with a model that fits on a watch. The results are what you'd expect from something purpose-built. It beats models 10 to 25 times its size on single-shot function calling. 6,000 tokens per second on prefill. Fine-tuning takes 45 minutes. You clone a repo, run a command, and you've got a custom tool calling model trained on your own tools on your laptop. And the weights are open. The dataset generation pipeline is open. The training code is open. Someone in the comments suggested publishing a live demo, which, yes, obviously. But the more important thing is that anyone can take this architecture and run with it, distill your own tiny specialist for your own toolset. One commenter raised the specter of Google's anti-distillation defenses, which is a real concern and also deeply funny. A company spending engineering resources to make its models harder to learn from. That's the closed system instinct in its purest form. Not how do we make this better, but how do we make sure nobody else can? Meanwhile, a small team just published the recipe for building a 26 million parameter model that solves a specific problem better than anything Google ships. The tools exist. The weights are on the internet. The fine-tuning runs on consumer hardware. This is how open source wins. Not by matching the big models feature for feature, but by making the right thing small enough that nobody can gatekeep it. Five stories in, and we haven't left software yet. Let's fix that. Story 5. A new stainless steel that laughs at seawater. In Yalza Surly, IBM faced a decision that would define mainframe computing for decades. The System 360 used a single architecture across an entire product line, which meant every component had to survive every use case. The expensive parts. The ones that made the machines prohibitively costly for smaller buyers. Want the processors? They were the interconnects. The structural materials. The physical chassis that had to tolerate heat and corrosion across wildly different operating environments. When IBM finally found ways to standardize those structural components with cheaper materials, the price curve broke open and computing spread to institutions that could never have afforded it before. Hydrogen electrolysis is sitting at exactly that inflection point right now. The electrochemistry works. The renewable electricity is increasingly available. The bottleneck is the box itself. In a proton exchange membrane electrolyzer. Structural component. The bipolar plates, the end plates, the flow fields account for roughly 53% of total system cost. And right now, those components are made from titanium coated with gold or platinum because nothing cheaper survives the environment. A team at the University of Hong Kong just published results on a stainless steel alloy designated SSH2 that changes the map. The core insight is elegant. Conventional stainless steel protects itself with a chromium oxide film, but that film breaks down around 1,000 millivolts. Water oxidation requires 1,600. The steel fails before the chemistry even starts. What the HKU team engineered is a sequential dual passivation system. The chromium oxide layer forms first, then a manganese-based layer forms on top at around 720 millivolts. Extending protection all the way to 1700. Manganese, which the field has historically considered detrimental to corrosion resistance, turns out to be the key to the Chait second shield. Run this forward 5 years. If SSH2 scale. And stainless steel manufacturing is one of the most mature industrial processes on Earth. The team estimates a 40-fold reduction in structural material costs. A 10-megawatt electrolyzer that currently costs millions in titanium and precious metals suddenly becomes economically viable with commodity steel. Seawater, which covers 70% of the planet, becomes a practical hydrogen feedstock. The chemistry was never the hard problem. The material science was. And someone just solved it with steel and manganese. Two of the cheapest, most abundant metals in industrial use. Let's talk about a text editor that turned 50 this year and somehow keeps winning. What does it actually mean for a piece of software to survive 50 years? Not as a museum exhibit. Not as a compatibility shim. As the daily tool of choice for millions of working programmers. Right now, in 2026. The V-Editor was born in 1977, and the story of how it proliferated is one of the purest case studies in why OpenBeats closed. V 2.0 shipped in 1979, locked behind AT&T's commercial Unix license. The software existed. It worked. People wanted it. And a corporation said, no, pay us first. The market's response was not to pay, it was to rebuild. Stovey for the Atari, ST, Elvis for MS, DOS, and Minix. File, derived from Micro Emacs. And eventually, Vim, which descended from Stovey and became arguably the most influential text editor ever written. Each clone was an act of defiance, dressed up as a weekend project. Each one said the same thing. This tool is too useful to be locked in a vault. Pull this thread to its logical extreme. AT&T had every legal right to restrict V. They had a license. They had contracts. They had lawyers. And it didn't matter. The idea of B. Modal editing, composable commands, the grammar of text manipulation was too powerful to contain. You can lock up an implementation, but you cannot lock up a paradigm. 17 distinct implementations now exist, from BusyBox's tiny embedded version to NeoVim with its built-in LSP support and Lua scripting engine. The original AT&T code eventually got open-sourced through OpenSolaris in 2005, but by then, the clones had already won. The engineering craft here deserves real admiration. Elvis introduced file-based buffering so you could edit files larger than available memory. On early 90s hardware, NVI used a database backend for file storage. NeoVim's architecture cleanly separates a UI from the core, enabling remote interfaces and embedded terminals. These aren't just copies. Each implementation explored a different point in the design space while preserving the fundamental interaction model. One of the comments captures something worth noting. With Claude Code and similar tools running in the terminal, people are gravitating back to Vim. The terminal is becoming the IDE again. And Vim's 50-year-old interaction model fits that world perfectly. Modal editing turns out to be exactly the right abstraction layer between a human and an AI coding assistant. AT&T tried to keep Pro-V proprietary. The community built 17 alternatives, and the paradigm outlived the corporation that created it. The tools exist because people refused to let them be scarce. We talked earlier about tools outlasting the companies that built them. SecurityBaseline.eu is betting on that same principle. Baz for defense. Every system I've ever built had a moment where I had to decide, do we expose the metrics or do we bury them? Exposing them is terrifying because numbers don't lie and people get uncomfortable. Burying them is easy, and it's exactly how things stay broken forever. The Internet Cleanup Foundation just chose the terrifying option for an entire continent. SecurityBaseline.eu launched today, monitoring 200,000 government websites across 32 European countries. Every night, it rebuilds over 1,800 maps across 21 security metrics. And the findings are exactly as uncomfortable as you'd expect. 3,000 government sites running illegal tracking cookies. Over 1,000 database management interfaces. PHP in my admin panels. Sitting there publicly reachable on the open internet. 99% of government email poorly encrypted. These aren't obscure subdomains. These are the front doors of the institutions that write your privacy laws. The engineering here deserves real respect. They built Web Security Map. The software powering this, over more than a decade, it crawls 200,000 domains across 67,000 local governments, maps them to 87 different regional boundaries. Because every European country structures its municipalities differently and layers all 21 metrics into traffic light visualizations anyone can read. Germany alone has so many administrative layers, it nearly broke their mapping system. They did it anyway. And here's what makes this bootstrapism at its finest. The code is open, the data is open, and they gave every government 3 months warning before publishing. This isn't a gotcha, it's a mirror. They're handing the tools to the people who need them most. The sysadmins inside those governments who've been screaming about that exposed PHP my admin panel for years and finally have public evidence to force action. One of the comments points out that genuine security testing is essentially illegal in countries like Germany, which means governments have criminalized the very activity that would have caught these problems. The people who built Security Baseline found a way around that wall. Passive measurement, open methodology, transparent publication. They didn't ask permission to make the internet safer. They just built the instrument and published the readings. The data is there. Every map updates nightly. Go look at your government.
So what happens when you give brilliant people room to be boring? Bell Labs had an answer. Let me make the case for the mundane. Let me make the case that Bell Labs' real magic wasn't the transistor. Actually, wait, let me make the stronger case first. The case against what I'm about to argue. The transistor changed everything. The solar cell changed everything. Information theory, the laser, Unix. Murray Hill was arguably the most productive research lab in human history. The applied division at Holmdel, they designed slide rulers so salesmen could estimate costs. They optimized private branch exchanges. They made the phone system slightly cheaper for mid-sized businesses. If you had to choose where to allocate your reverence, Murray Hill wins in a landslide. And that case is wrong, not because Holmdel was secretly more important, but because Murray Hill without Holmdel is a university department. Brilliant, decorated, and utterly unable to deliver a dial tone to 200 million people. This interview is a portrait of institutional competence. The kind that doesn't get conference talks or Wikipedia pages. Craig, the author's father, enters Bell Labs through the one-year on-campus program, where the company paid your salary and tuition to get a master's degree in whatever they needed you to learn. Over 130 people in a single cohort. Bell Labs didn't just hire smart people. They manufactured expertise at industrial scale, pointed it at specific operational problems, then deployed it. And here's the architectural question worth asking. Why could Bell Labs afford to run what was essentially a free graduate school? Because it was a regulated monopoly. The phone system was closed. One provider guaranteed revenue, no competitive pressure to cut costs quarter over quarter. That stability funded both Murray Hill's moonshots and Holmdel's operational grind. The irony is sharp. The most productive open research in American history was bankrolled by the most closed business model imaginable. When deregulation broke the monopoly, the research funding evaporated. The boring applied work disappeared first. Then, the moonshots followed. The lesson isn't that monopolies are good. It's that sustained, boring, applied engineering requires sustained, boring, predictable funding. And right now, the open source ecosystem is figuring out exactly this problem. How to fund the maintainers, the infrastructure work, the slide ruler designers, without recreating the monopoly that made Bell Labs possible. The glamorous part of Bell Labs got the Nobel Prizes. The boring part made the phones work. We remember the ROM hat. We talked earlier about tools shaping how we think. Story 9. How to make your text look futuristic. Typography is a technology. We forget this because it's ancient. Because it's everywhere. Because we stopped noticing it the way we stopped noticing air. But every letter form is an engineering decision. Stroke width, terminal angle, kerning ratio. Optimized for a specific communication problem. And the communication problem Dave Addy dissects in this piece is deceptively hard. How do you make someone feel a time period they've never experienced? His six rules are brilliant in their specificity. Italic slant, curved and angular hybridization. Consummate V-shapes on letter terminals. Ligature kerning. Arbitrary segment removal. And then the texture layer. Brushed metal, blue lighting, embossing, star fields. He walks through each rule with a single word, transforming it step by step from present to future. And the progression is genuinely revelatory. Now, the devil's advocate position here is obvious. These are cliches. Every sci-fi franchise, from Blade Runner to Battlestar Galactica to Back to the Future, uses the same bag of tricks. Shouldn't that make them failures? Shouldn't a truly futuristic typeface look like nothing we've seen before? No, and this is what makes the analysis worth taking seriously. These conventions work precisely because they're shared. They form a visual pidgin language, a set of typographic signals that an audience can decode instantly without instruction. Italic means motion. Angular means precision. Ligatures mean integration. Metallic texture means industrial scale. None of these associations are natural. They were constructed film by film, decade by decade, through repetition and reinforcement. They're an open standard for communicating futurity, and anyone can use them. One commenter noted how dated some of these futuristic fonts now seem. That's not a bug. It tells you something profound about how we imagine the future. It's always an extrapolation from the present aesthetic. Never a clean break. The future, typographically speaking, is whatever today's design language looks like if you push every slider 10% further. More slant, more angular, more merged, more textured. The tools are right there. Go make something that looks like tomorrow. We've covered a lot of ground today. Now for one that hits close to home for anyone who builds things. A developer I know once mass replied to a Slack thread with, "That would add complexity," and genuinely could not understand why the product team stopped inviting him to planning meetings. This article nails something I've been chewing on. There are two loops running in every software company simultaneously. Loop one is uncertainty reduction. The business trying to figure out what works, what customers want, what to build next. Loop two is complexity management. Senior developers trying to keep the system understandable, debuggable, teachable, stable. Ugh. The failure mode is predictable. Product says, "We need to test this new feature." The senior dev hears, "More code to maintain," and responds with a wall of technical concerns. Legitimate concerns, but framed entirely in loop two language. Maintenance costs, architectural debt, system complexity. Meanwhile, the person asking is living in loop one. They need to reduce uncertainty. They need to know if this idea works before the quarter ends. The prescription here is genuinely elegant. Five words. Can we try something quicker? That phrase does triple duty. Quicker acknowledges the speed they actually need. Something implies you have an alternative path. Try accepts imperfection while leaving room for it to be good enough. You're exercising the exact same engineering judgment. Reduce, reuse, avoid building what's unnecessary. But you're expressing it as a solution to their problem instead of a complaint about yours. Want survey data? Google Forms. Want to test a feature? Put a button in the existing UI and see if anyone clicks it. Need analytics? Start with one decision, one chart, one metric. The article's best line. You want to bake me a birthday cake? Just put a candle on my sandwich. One commenter pushed back, noting that proof of concepts always become production. They're not wrong. The promised rewrite never comes. But that's a management problem, not an argument against resourcefulness. The candle on sandwich approach still beats building a bakery to test whether anyone wants cake. The article cuts off mid-word on responsibility, which is either a server error or the most perfectly ironic ending I've ever seen. Senior developers take responsibility. That's the job. But responsibility expressed as gatekeeping is just obstruction with better vocabulary. Responsibility expressed as resourcefulness. Finding the fastest path to an answer with the least new code. That's expertise praise people actually want to hear from. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 13th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quinn3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something worth sharing. We'll see you back here tomorrow.